This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I am Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone or tablet and search for DC 37 State of the Union. And members, there are now more ways to stay in touch with the union. You can check out the website, www.dc37.net. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you have any comments about our show or would like us to promote a community event, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. That's stateoftheunion@dc37.net. This is a very special show for us. Tonight, we welcome in the studio composer and NYU professor of music, Julia Wolf. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Julia Wolf is an internationally celebrated composer. She is a 2016 MacArthur Fellow. She is a Pulitzer Prize winner for her concert-length oratorio called Anthracite Fields. And we're talking because in January, there was a production of a work that my producer has described as large-scale for orchestra and women's chorus. It was performed by the New York Philharmonic with The Crossing and the Young People's Chorus of New York City. It is called Fire in My Mouth. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
How did Fire in My Mouth come about?
It's a good question because I haven't spent all of my musical life working with orchestras. That's a very big entity, big, you know, group to work with. But I happened to have a performance of an earlier work called Anthracite Fields, which was also a kind of labor history documentation in the form of music.
Which won the Pulitzer Prize.
It did. A very earthy piece for a fancy prize. But they had presented on one of their festivals, and afterwards the head of the orchestra came up and said, can you make a piece like that for us? Which he meant for the New York Philharmonic. And I was like, yeah, thinking, I have no idea if I can do that. How do I do that? I've written for orchestra before, but you know, maybe every 7 years or something. So I said yes. And they also asked, can it be a New York story? And a lot of my work has, at least recent work, has focused on, they've been kind of subject pieces. And I've been looking at American labor history, beginning with a piece called Steel Hammer, where I took a look at the John Henry ballad and man working, you know, against machine. Then on to the coal mining piece. And so I started thinking about what other story have I been thinking about that interests me? And I thought about the women working in the garment industry, partly because I walk by where I teach at NYU is right near where the fire happened.
Actually was.
So I've been walking by that building forever, looking at the little plaque on the building. I also have some friends who have been involved in keeping the memory alive. They're part of the memorial activities. And I came back and I said, I'm going to write this piece for you guys about the women, the immigrant women, primarily young immigrant women who were involved in that industry at that time.
So this is an academic. This comes as an academic endeavor, something that is labor, something that speaks to you academically, or is it something that is there labor in your family? What is the connection to labor?
And right. Why am I interested in this?
Which, by the way, is very important in the year 2019 that art and music and culture connect to labor, because we have finally broken through, I think. The labor movement has finally broken through, and I think they've broken through in terms of public opinion and how people feel about the labor movement because of stories. Because
absolutely.
And how did you come to labor as a topic?
So you're asking if it's academic. I'm not that academic. I do teach. I came to teaching much later, so I'm really sort of an artist first, and I've always been interested in well, always been interested in music, but when I went to college, for example, I didn't think I was going to study music. I was interested in social sciences and political issues, and I went to a school that had a lot of activity like that. And somehow I accidentally wandered into a music class, and then I got the bug. And so,
like Willie Mays wandering onto a baseball field.
Yeah, it's kind of like that. Okay. I like that, Willie Mays, like that association. So these pieces are kind of, I guess, a return back to that early interest. I've always been politically conscious and, you know, interested in how we work and how we treat each other. And so it's just interesting now that it's folding back into the music. And in a certain sense, I guess the only way that you might think of it as academic is I do a lot of research. And by research, I just mean I glean, I go out, I interview people. It's like, you know, the way people do oral histories, they talk to people. So I interview people, I look at documentaries and read a lot of books and go to the locations. And so I immerse myself in whatever world I'm examining or taking a look at. And very important to connect to the people, being very respectful of the people involved in these industries, certainly with the coal mining piece, wanting to really listen to what their story is, not just say, I know what I'm going to write about, not going in with any preconceived notions, really hearing them out. So I guess the interest has been always been there, and now it's being expressed in this kind of poetic, memorial way.
Again, let's go back to, I mean, this is a huge endeavor. It's the New York Philharmonic. It's a large chorus, and the sound. Actually, we're going to listen to a bit of the sound, just a snippet, and then we can talk some more about that. How do you bring the voices, the instrumentation, how do you bring all this together?
Well, I start with the text. Actually, I write the text. I say I write the text, but really I do a combination of hunting and gathering. So I'm using found texts like bits of oral history, snippets. You know, a lot of the immigrants were, especially in this industry, were interviewed. And so I actually got access to both oral documentation and written documentation. The whole opening is a woman who came over on a boat with her four sisters, and she's just saying, without passports or anything, we took a boat, a big, beautiful boat. You know, and she's describing this idea of coming, of leaving a place she had to leave and coming to a place where she feels a lot of hope and optimism. So, you know, that's a text that was very beautiful. A lot of times I'll use parts of speeches. There's some great speeches. There were amazing speakers, especially these feisty women who were leading the charge for the garment workers, and they said amazing things, I mean, things that really just grabbed your heart. And so sometimes I'm writing the text just because I'm making like a simple list. Sometimes I'm setting a list of names. So in this piece, I've set every person who was lost in that fire, their name is sung at the end of the piece. That's 146 names. It's a lot to say. So I begin with that. And then, you know, the wonderful thing about music is it's beyond words. You know, it's expressing some kind of emotional state or physical state. And so once that combines with words, it's becomes something else. It becomes another way of telling a story. So but I think the most telling moment musically is probably the second movement. It's called Factory. And I was amazed that the New York Philharmonic was game, but I basically made them sound like a factory. They're making all kinds of really crunchy sounds, trying to get sounds that sound almost like sewing machines.
Right, right.
So when you're rolling sticks on a rim of a drum, like it sounds like sewing machine.
That's right.
Of course, there was no documentation at that time, no oral documentation. It was probably just the beginning of like Edison experiments or something. So I just have descriptions, people saying I would walk onto the factory floor and the roar of the machine. So I have the freedom to decide, well, what does that, how do I want to make that sound in an orchestra? And the players were game. They were doing strange sounds, crunching their bows against the strings, blowing air into their brass instruments. So that's not a typical thing they do.
I saw a wonderful piece on YouTube that was the production. And I sat there watching you talk to the conductor and watching. I thought, what are they saying? Because I'm listening to the sounds that are being made, and I'm wondering when you're making, when it's happening, when you know it's just what you wanted, or it's like, no, I need a little bit more of this from you. Or and what was that experience like when you're working with the New York Philharmonic?
It's wild. Because you've got over 100 people on stage. They're all like the top of their game. They're all experts on their instrument. So on one hand, I'm going to trust that they know their instrument better than I do.
Right.
But on the other hand, I have something in mind. So, you know, at one point, I actually have them doing this crazy thing where they take their bows. Now, these bows are really expensive, so this was a big ask. And they're whipping them in the air.
Oh, so that is like, a big ass.
Like that. It's a great sound. It almost sounds like a match lighting or, you know, it could be anything. But I start the last movement, which is called Fire, with this, all the strings doing that. And I really needed them to go with some strength. And so I, at one moment, I stopped them. We have to try that. We have to hear that. Which I think they thought was funny. And they made a joke. Well, you know how much these bows cost. I don't think they're actually using their most expensive bows on my piece. They have a second bow. So, you know, it's for some of the things that use the back of the wood of the bow or do unusual things.
But they yeah. came in knowing that they were going to be asked to make these sounds. I mean, that was clear before you even.
They get their parts. So they get their parts, I don't know how, 6 weeks, let's say, ahead of the first rehearsal. And then they may have some questions about them. But, you know, I think in this context, they know why I'm doing that. They know I'm not just, they do get to play some melodies and some harmonies and, but they know why I'm asking for those sounds and why I'm trying to get this huge force of sound because of the meaning of the piece. And so they wanted to be a part of it.
Let me just, we're talking with NYU music professor Julia Wolf. Her latest production is called Fire in My Mouth. I did not ask you the key question of what is the significance of the title.
The title came from an interview that I heard with Clara Lemlich. And so Clara Lemlich was a real fireball. She was a Russian emigre. She came here as a teenager. She's self-educated. And she was on the forefront of unionizing and organizing a collective voice for the garment workers. She was beaten up by thugs, broke 6 ribs, was back on the picket line. I mean, she was quite a dynamo. And years later, I think in the 1960s or so, they were interviewing her, and she said, ah, then I had fire in my mouth. And she meant I was really feisty back the day. But, of course, a strange reference. I don't think she necessarily thought about the fire. And so I thought, well, what a beautiful line, kind of captures both the reference to the fire, but also to her spirit. And so
fire
there
it
was.
And you only get to produce this production. I mean, it played in New York January 24th and January 25th, and then it stops. And does it go somewhere else? How does a production this size live on?
That's what composers often think about. Where was my next gig?
Right.
So this is a tricky one to put together because there are a lot of moving parts. There's also a very beautiful video component, and that was created by my collaborator Jeff Sugg, and he uses archival material. So it's a big project to put up. Not every orchestra is going to do that, but we've already gotten some interest. It looks like it's going to happen in Oregon with the Oregon Symphony. Some other people have checked into there. Someone asked about it from the Netherlands. And so now that we have all the documentation. We have a CD, a live recording. We have the means to kind of start these conversations. So I think it'll happen again.
How can listeners access this music? You're on Spotify?
Yep. Everything's on Spotify now. So the CD is called Fire in My Mouth, and under my name, Julia Wolf. You can stream it. You can download it. Yeah. So you wouldn't see the visual part, but there's some documentation online to see.
The piece on YouTube, like. And I do recommend to all listeners to go to YouTube and to just watch this being made, because it is a fascinating. And again, the connection between art, between music, and the labor movement is such an important way of telling the story. I knew this was going to go by way too quickly. You have an open invitation to come and talk about anything you want to talk about on this show. It's been a fascinating 15 minutes. Unfortunately, that's all it is 15 minutes. But thank you very much. The production is called Fire in My Mouth. We're talking with Julia Wolf, who is a 2016 MacArthur Fellow and a Pulitzer Prize winner. It has been a delight to meet you and to talk to you about your work.
It's an honor to be here.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. This fall, DC 37 made history by unifying with our AFSCME brothers and sisters at DC 1707 and its six local unions, locals 95, 107, 205, 215, 253, and 389, bringing DC 37's total membership to 150,000. They will comprise a new private sector division within DC 37, with each local union structure and leadership remaining unchanged. DC 37 Executive Director Henry Garrido said the unification signals a new era in the fight for workers' rights here in New York City. He noted that the convergence of public and private sector unions within DC 37 creates organizing opportunities that are essential to building union power at a time when political forces are trying to erode workers' rights. The unification yielded early positive results this summer when Local 205's early childhood educators who work for nonprofit organizations overwhelmingly ratified a wage parity agreement which boosts their salaries by as much as 30%. Here now, joining us to talk about the contract and what this means is James Parrott, Director of Economic and Fiscal Policies at the New Schools Center for New York City Affairs. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You wrote a piece in the Daily News recently that called the agreement historic. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so salary parity between nonprofit CBO, community-based organization, early childhood education centers, and early childhood education counterparts in the public school system, that is in the UPK part of the public education system. There's been a significant salary disparity for a long time. And this agreement, is a real breakthrough in terms of achieving starting pay salary parity. And actually, by the calculations that I've done on this, it looks like the certified teachers who will get the biggest bump up in pay as part of this will get increases coming to close to 40% over the next 2 years. And so this is something that's been recognized, that this pay disparity has been recognized for years. And finally, this year, things came together, the stars aligned, and the city agreed to finally implement salary parity.
And it was, in your opinion, this was a big rock to climb up the hill, to push up the hill? I mean, it's been a long time.
That the sector, the advocates in the early childhood education community have been pushing for years. They stepped up their organizing and mobilization on that this year. They were able to convince the city council members and the speaker that this is a significant budget priority for the council to achieve that. That together with the unification that you spoke of, bringing together 1707 and 37, really that was the final star that needed to be aligned to make this happen.
And what does this mean? What does this mean for the education of children in the city?
So there had been a significant problem for the last several years with the nonprofit CBOs having real turnover problems, a real difficulty in recruiting and retaining qualified teachers, because if a teacher was certified, they could go to the public school system and see their salary increase substantially. So that meant that there were a lot of understaffed centers, and a lot of the teaching was done by people who didn't always have the essential certification. So this will change that situation and help the nonprofits recruit and retain certified teachers. That will improve the quality, the continuity of care and the instruction in the early childhood education sectors, and that's going to be good for the kids and the families who utilize those centers all across the city.
And I believe in the Daily News piece that you wrote, you were suggesting that this could have national implications.
Well, so this is there have been instances here and there where there's been moves towards salary disparity, towards salary parity. This is a nationwide challenge. A lot of early childhood. In fact, 5 out of every 6 of the teachers in the early childhood education sector are private sector employees. They're not public school teachers.
That's interesting.
So this is the first time in a major school system where there's been a commitment to achieve salary parity between the nonprofit sector and the community-based sector and the school system.
And we've just got a little bit of time left. I don't want to put you on the spot, but to get away from the politics, this is a step in the right direction in terms of the inequality problem. One hopes.
Yeah, because this is a workforce. If you look at the workers who staff these centers and the teachers, they're predominantly women of color. The children and the families served in these city-funded centers all across the city are largely low and moderate income families, a lot of from communities of color. So this will help improve the quality of their instruction. It will make parenting easier for those families. And it's a very positive thing. Now, what remains to happen, needs to happen, is that there are other things that need to be achieved on the salary parity front. And having a strong agreement like this and a stronger combined union with 37 and 1707 together behind this will make it easier going forward. But, you know, right now there are still a lot of nonprofits and CBOs that are not part of the union contract, so they could not only extend the benefits of salary parity to of this agreement to their certified teachers, but their other staffs would benefit from much better pension, health insurance programs, and regular pay increases.
Three words for that: organize, organize, organize. James Parrott is the director of economic and fiscal policy at the New School Center for New York City Affairs. Once again, thank you always for helping explain the world to us a little bit.
Thank you.
And we look forward to talking to
all
you
right,
again,
good
sir.
To be on. All right. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Before we go, a few announcements. Members, continue to visit Union Headquarters at 125 Barclay Street for activities and services to help meet your needs. DC 37 staff members have moved to temporary offices at 55 Water Street, but you can reach your union reps by calling the same phone numbers that you have in the past. And for ongoing updates, call 212-815-1000. Or visit www.dc37.net and the union's social media sites. If you're a DC 37 member and you're interested in running for office, we've got a good thing for you. You can sign up for DC 37's three Saturday sessions. It's called Emerging Leaders Candidate Training. It's a program that's going to take place over three Saturdays, October's 5th and 19th. And November 2nd, it's all taking place at 9 a.m. at 125 Barclay Street. You must commit to all three classes, and you must register by September 30th. And for details, you can call 212-815-1550. But don't take too much time on this, because September 30th is tomorrow. The union holds a three-day financial empowerment workshop on Thursdays, October 10th, 11th. The Ed Fund holds a three-day financial empowerment workshop Thursday, October 10th, 17th, and 24th at 6 p.m. Full location and details, call 212-815-1700. You can register by going to www.dc37edfund.org and look for the /financial empowerment. But I would recommend calling 212-815-1700. Also, check out the DC 37 Rewards program to achieve real savings while getting a great price for a hotel room, ball game, or other products. To register, visit www.dc37rewards.com. And remember, if you have any comments about today's show or any of our shows, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. We appreciate your feedback. That's about all the time we've got for tonight. I want to thank our guests, composer, NYU music professor Julia Wolf, and James Parrott, who is director of economic and fiscal policies at the New School Center for NYC Affairs. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I am Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.